Oh, okay. It's about a Redivis RT85. It says it's a legal Baofeng replacement.
It is actually whole line of that company. So the regulation, if you click on it just a minute or so later, is going to give you the list of requirement for European Union, which is 50 megahertz to 1,000 megahertz. The harmonics supposed to be less than 60 dBs, and 1,000 megahertz to 4 gigahertz, lesser than 50 dBs, which translates to 1 microwatt or minus 30 dBs. That is interesting because this radio is forbidden to sell. It's not that radio, it's the line. But also it translates to the whole line of it, including walkie-talkie. They are not on ham radio band. The radio costs $32.54 US, and the shipping is $11.16. So it's quite inexpensive. And that video also explains the methods of you measuring the level of harmonics by yourself if you want to. You want to give few words about it?
Well, it's kind of difficult to watch a YouTube while I'm doing a technical net here, and I don't know how much of it I watched. Again, something like 2-3 weeks ago. It looks like a cheap radio on a chip, which is probably why Baofeng is thought of. So. I'm familiar with the brand name. There are people who have that brand radio out there. All these Chinese radios seem to have that problem. There's a degree of quality assurance, and also sometimes they don't bother to get them checked. So intermod distortion and harmonics and all kinds of terrible things are awful. I vaguely remember a YouTube I saw of the ARRL, where he took, I think it was a Baofeng, and he measured the harmonics and just demonstrated that they were god-awful. Not something that you could pick up without the measuring equipment, but still. So it's not unusual for Chinese-manufactured radios to not really comply with any known standard in technology.
Yeah, the reason that I gave you that that video is because at the end of that video it says about ICOM 705 and the worry of the author of that video that it doesn't really fall into the requirements of European Union 2. Now, as far as the methods of measurements, you connecting it's a 10 watts. So you're connecting to the input, the output of the radio that to the input of your spectral analyzer using attenuator, because then you're going to damage it permanently. And then you can see the harmonics of it. And if your spectrum analyzer is able to show it in the numerical value, see what is the strength of it. Back to you.
Okay. That's certainly interesting. Unfortunately, I think a lot of people end up being a little depressed at the results of their measurement. People, I think, tend to be somewhat optimistic about their equipment. And if you do put it through a whole calibration test and you give them all the specs, I'm sure they'll find areas of disappointment, especially with Chinese manufacturers. There's a lot of variability, as far as I'm aware, in the output of these factories. They may all look alike and feel alike, but we've had cases here where people's bowel functions weren't quite doing what they expected them to do, and they found that they had been set at the factory for extra narrow FM transmissions, among other problems that they have. And certainly, I don't really believe most of the power output ratings for the higher-end handy talkies made in China. A lot of times they'll be sold as 7-watt outputs, and usually if people do the tests on YouTube, they'll find that they're about 4, 4.5 watts. So doesn't really surprise me. You know, it's a thing that the FCC has to keep on checking on, and every so often, I remember a year or two ago, we had this kind of outcry that all bowel functions would be made illegal. Because they were very, the FCC was very upset that they were being sold in big box stores, where there's no need to prove that you have any kind of a license. And yet, as far as I'm aware, there's as many bowel functions around as there ever have been.
Do you think that that restriction can come to United States for that radio or that brand? Or maybe some other Chinese product, and that might be because the price is incredibly different from reputable companies selling their products. So I remember when I was buying Gaikom or Yesu walkie-talkies, portable radios, for $600. 20 years ago. So imagine what was the value of the dollar then. And now we have a $32 radio. It has actually whole features. Do you think that this is somehow related to the quality product on the American market?
Well, I think it's a complicated economic series of questions. Chinese manufacturers have very, very low labor costs, and they buy in large bulks, and they get recompensed by the Chinese government. Chinese Communist Party bankrolled shipping, making it ridiculously cheap to get stuff all the way from China. If you want to buy something at Alibaba or on eBay, a lot of times the shipping is free. If you wanted to send that thing back to them and you had to pay shipping, it would easily start to cost you at least $20 plus. So there's a lot of subsidizing going on, and there's a lot of simplification of the circuit design. It's a radio on a chip. So it cuts down on labor and such. And unfortunately, without proper supervision, a lot of Chinese industry, unfortunately, has kind of built-in quality assurance problems. They have this lovely Chinese word called chubadol, which basically means kind of, make it just sort of kind of work. Just put in the least amount of effort to have it functional, and that should suffice. So mediocrity, this goes beneath the level of mediocrity. And if you have people like Apple, where Apple employees are on Foxconn's floors every day making sure that the quality is up to par, you get high-quality stuff. If you don't, you don't necessarily get high-quality stuff. So the quality assurance of Chinese manufacturers is sort of a gamble. I tell people, if you want to save a lot of money and you want to buy it by Alibaba, so be it. But if it comes to you with the wrong screw size and it doesn't quite work right or it looks completely different, then there's not much you can do. You can complain. Sometimes they'll refund you. Sometimes they'll make believe that they don't understand English.
Coming back to another radio, it's Lab 599. A few words about it. Lab 599 was becoming extremely popular, although the production was never in progress, or in full progress, few hams received that radio. It was made by a Russian company before the war. And looking at the spec, it was 0.5 to 56 megahertz general receiver coverage, 1 to 10 watts, adjustable, and the battery life was 10 times the normal battery life because they didn't use the full LCD or, LED, but they used the old LCD display. The 48 kilohertz built-in high-speed PON adapter and a digital high-performance filtering for receive to transmit, in and out output for firmware update through the internet, CW and voice messages in memory. So it's good if you don't want to repeat the standard message in CW, but you want just to interact if there is a station that is that wants to talk to you. It's good. CW and voice beacon mode and antenna SWR monitor. Did you hear about that radio?
Vaguely, I'm sure I saw some promotions for it, individuals. I've seen more than a few Russian-built radios whenever I see them. They look interesting in different ways. I think his son, SDR, is also a Russian design. Basically, it's a Intel PC-based computer built into a sort of an SDR radio. My problem has always been that of all the countries to buy my stuff, I am least likely to buy Russian because I kind of look at it as a method of losing your money. I buy expensive radios, built in America. Flex Radio is built in America. If I had to send them back and got something like two or three replacements entirely from them, and they've always had great customer care. I look almost as much at customer care as the technology involved. I don't know anyone who has these Russian radios, so I haven't heard any hard luck stories, but I haven't heard any good stories. And I would caution people, if you want to play around with an inexpensive Chinese design, then so be it. If you're going to put $800,000 down, I think you should be a little bit more cautious with your money. I don't know the price of the 599, which is also sometimes called a TX500. Again, I'm always suspicious of Russian manufacturers. I don't trust them at this point.
Interesting. I absolutely agree with you. Interesting was that the transmitter's body was made of, or is made, of durable aluminum by the method of precision milling to ensure high-quality snipe protection and provide good heat removal from the output part of the transceiver. I was reading the description of it. So it's quite unique, probably. Probably it came from the fact that the number of pieces to be sold was not too great yet, and the manufacturer was actually a small team of engineers, or possibly some crooks. We don't know that, but we know that there is a quite few pieces that is owned by American amateurs, and they are pretty much satisfied with the radio. Probably right now there is no way to get the radio any longer, but I understand that the labor in Russia is probably compatible to Chinese one, because before the war there was approximately 180 dollars average earning per month, the lower range of it for Russians, and after the war it devalued itself to approximately $59 per month for retiree pension. So I assumed that the company had an access to a CNC milling machine, and they were able to really make a quite nice looking product. Anodizing was another story, but it was pretty much solid. So it looks like the company was really trying to get a grip on good quality. Back to you.
Yeah, I mean, it has an interesting look. It has a monochrome screen, which is really kind of retro 10 years ago. I mean, I don't mind monochrome screens. My ICOM 7100 that I'm using right now tonight has a monochrome screen, and I love this radio. But nowadays, everything seems to be color screen and such. You know, even a little nano VNA is a color screen. So that's kind of out of date. Maybe it's what they had in inventory, or they're trying to keep the price point low. I tend to try and either buy American, or if it's a foreign country, it either has to have a very good reputation or a distribution network in the United States or Canada that provides proper service. I could easily see pulling out what little hairs I have left, trying to get some company in Russia to make good on a warranty on a radio from there. So interesting, curious. Again, I kind of say the same thing every so often when I see interesting novel designs being shown out of China that aren't being made in the millions and sold rather cheaply. But at this point, I don't think there's anything special that you can't do elsewhere with a lot less risk.
Yes, it is. So I assume radio is not to be purchased. I got the general features in front of me. So it's 160 to 6 meters amateur radio band. General receiver coverage 0.5 to 56 megahertz, almost single side band, CW, DIG, DIC, AM, FM, high performance 32-bit floating point DSP, current drain as low as 100 milliamps in receive mode, backlit on preamp off no signal. External power supply 9 to 15 volts, up to from 1 to 3 amps, typical in transmit. High contrast LCD, 256 by 128 pixels. High performance real time pan adapter, 48 kilohertz wide, and one click online firmware update. It's a small radio. It looks like a military style. It's extremely rigid. Has non-typical connections, but the company, the manufacturer, gives you the connectors, actually everything that you need for it. It was also seen to adapt the external battery that is actually snapped to the back of the radio, and is extremely thin. I mean, you may probably be able to describe it better.
Well, yeah, as you mentioned it, by the way, AC2GS, it's a long, thin, flat, you know, almost like take a 2x4 and cut it down a great deal with connectors on either end. It's sort of designed, I guess, to be an Elecraft killer. I'm sure it costs a fraction of the amount of money that a Elecraft QRP radio does. But I would feel much happier with an Elecraft than this particular model, which, by the way, actually is a color display, although it's not at least from the picture, it's not terribly colorful. And again, the problem with LCD displays for portable radios is that in bright sunlight, the illumination, displays kind of fail. And there's even a mention in this particular article that you sent me a link to where they say that it can be incredibly difficult to read in full sunlight. So you got to think in terms of that as well. Interesting design. Wouldn't invest any money in it personally. Curious of people who did. I don't think I've ever talked to anyone. I mean, it seems like every other guy that I talk to on the HF bands has a 7300. I'm curious how long that trend's going to stay. Haven't really bumped into too many people with 705s. The 705 strikes me as a very nice QRP radio. I kind of like its specs. Don't really need a QRP radio personally, so I haven't invested in it. But, you know, it's from a known manufacturer. You were mentioning the cost of your HDs in the past. And, yeah, I mean, one of the main things that amazed me about a Baofeng is it would cost me more to get a case to cover my ICOM 92AD, my first radio, than it would for an entire Baofeng radio with all the extras added. So it's sort of amazing what you can do with a very sophisticated radio on a chip, very low labor costs, and a government that basically gives you money to make things. But, you know, almost all of us have a Baofeng in some drawer someplace. I have mine. I think I turned it on 8-9 months ago. Don't really use it much. I consider it my disposable handy-talkie. You know, if I somehow lose it, if it drops into the ocean, I will not shed much of a tear because it just didn't cost that much.
My first radio was in 1970, before 1970. See, I started to play with radio when I was 9 years old. In Europe, and the Russian terror, that was impossible to get anything that was built in. It was a dream for ham radio operators, so we were forced to build our transceivers. Some were using the military gears, but most of ham radio operators were simply building. And it was not only in Poland, but actually in entire Europe, including Russia. I wonder who from the ham radio operators listening to that would say about their first radio introduction.
Okay, Wes, we'll throw it out there. I'm a relatively newbie. Had my license for 11 years, and these days it's very difficult to build and or design or even build from a kit. Everything is surface mount and packed very, very tightly, and you basically needed an electrical engineering degree to get anywhere. So those days were long past when I got my license, but if there's anyone out there who would like to reminisce about their first radio, feel free.
WB2 reagent.
Yes, Ed. I mentioned you earlier tonight because Rich W2BZ is planning to build one of those interesting verticals that utilize common mode radiation as one of the legs of a dipole.
Before I get onto my first radio, what does that antenna have to do with me? Why? What was the linkage?
We discussed it a few months ago. It was in an article of QST. You found it interesting. You were considering doing some experiments.
Alas, that never happened. I'm sorry. I dropped it like a proverbial hot potato and some other stuff dropped up.
Yes, I thought as much. QST didn't respond to it much either. I scanned the letters to the editor for the next few months to see if anyone had any comment, and no one did. Just another antenna idea. I saw another individual who had built a similar one and written up a web page on it. I always say that if I was ever going to invent something, it would be the 25th hour of the day, just so that we had more time to waste.
Did that, there'd be a crushing demand for a 26th and then a 27th.
Yes, indeed. People can get greedy. I mean, I don't know if you've been following, but leap seconds are now considered an anathema. We're doing away with leap seconds.
With leap years, but I read somewhere a long time ago that every 200 years we have to have two extra days. Are you familiar with that? I'm very hazy on it. I'm not sure I ever understood it fully. It's just that, you know, the Earth does not go around the sun every 365.25 revolutions. A little bit off that, and I think they said every 200 years we have to do an additional fleet.
I don't think that's a function anymore. It might have been at one time or another, because that was a nuisance problem with the leap seconds. We had fine-tuned the adjustment, and you're quite correct that the orbit around the sun is not set in stone. There's a little bit of wobbling going on, so it does fluctuate. It gets faster and slower depending upon, you know, the cycles and such. But the whole point of the leap second is that even with the leap days and such, we were still out by a second or two, and so they would insert a corrective leap second. So I don't think there's a two-day gap, because then instead of having a leap second, there's no sense in my mind of making a leap second if you're a day and a half out of sync with the celestial region. So I'm not quite sure if that's still the case.
Is it possible, instead of predicting something 200 years in the future, they'll just wait till all the errors accumulate to 24.00 hours and throw an extra leap day then?
It's possible, but I think what actually happened is, in addition to the usual leap day that we have, every 100 years they add another day. And since it hasn't come up lately, we don't realize it. But I think that's sort of built into the calendar as well. So that's probably where that comes from.
Well, on top of Y2K 23 odd years ago, I was waiting to see if they were going to say something about an extra leap year, but that never did happen. I was wondering, all right, maybe it's 2100, not 2000. But all right. Now, shall I get to the question why I called in?
Suddenly.
I got my novice and technician licenses during the summer between my junior and senior years of high school. So I went back to school in September. I did find out the high school did have an amateur radio club. They did have a station, and I became very active in it. And I still remember during lunch times, I would go to our radio shack, and I would work with our EX40 crystal controlled at the time, 75 watts, which was the novice limit then, was 75 watts crystal controlled within the novice frequency band. And I was usually at 7178, which now is in a voice band, but then it was a novice UW band. That's what I had a crystal for. And the receiver was an Hamelund HQ-129X. Now, this was the September of 1962. Does that help, Roy?
Yes, it certainly does, and I thank you for that. Just as an aside, I took the opportunity to Google as your friend, and the rule is a little bit more esoteric. The leap year, the rule is, apparently, a year that is divisible by 100 and not divisible by 400, leap year is skipped. So it's not that it's a positive leap year every 100 years, it's a negative one. And so being that it has a lack of a leap year, leap day, we don't really realize that it's a correction like that. It's just we go that February ends in 28th and we move on to March. So that's the story behind that. It's if it's divisible by 100 and not divisible by 400, the leap year is skipped.
That like in the semiconductor theory of electrons and holes, where the holes travel?
I wish it was. It would make it much more fascinating. I remember years ago, John, may rest in peace, was fascinated by the idea of virtual holes in semiconductors. That's kind of like a virtual, what would that be, a virtual day or a virtual negative day? I don't know how you would kind of quantize it. I'm sure you could make it obscure and obtuse because quantum mechanics has a skill set for that.
All right. If you want me to go back to my first personally owned ham radio?
Sure, we got lots of time.
It had to be about, I don't know, a year later. I still was in high school, but I think it was towards the end of my senior year. But I didn't really get it up and running for a while, but I bought an old Nitron T50. Now, the Nitron T50 was very famous in that era, but this was the previous model, the T50, which had a single 807, ran 50 watts play power, also crystal controlled, and the receiver was an S86. Now, the classic Hallicrafters receiver then that everybody had was the SX-110. Apparently, the S86 was kind of equivalent to that. It was a general coverage receiver with band spreading for the ham band. And without the X meant it was a lower cost unit. I think it actually had, if I remember right, a transformerless power supply. And the connection of the power plug was critically important because you had to be careful because you could accidentally have a hot chassis if you weren't careful. And that's totally verboten today. But in any event, I was living not too far from where you are now and in a high-rise building. And my parents, I, and my brother had three bedrooms in a row with windows. And I was luckily in the center. Of course, my father helped me build a little bracket that would fit in the aluminum part of the windows that would stick out a foot. And I was able to run a 15-meter dipole from window to window to window about a foot out from the building, and it actually worked fantastically well once I got my act together.
Very good. To talk about these things that have live chassis, I was once a victim of an American 5. You remember those?
Yeah, the American 5 was a standard design, came out, I guess it was post-World War II, maybe pre-World War II, it was 5. I think it started with aqua-based loops. It was an AM-only broadcast receiver in a box that was, say, typically about a little under a foot by 6 inches by 6 inches. And I think it started with 5 aqua tubes. I think by the 50s, they kept the same design, basically just changing it to 5 miniature 7-pin tubes.
Yep, it was a beauty. It was cheap, and they made a bunch of them. And my parents planted one on the basement kitchen windowsill, right next to the faucet.
Oh, God, no.
Oh, God, yes, indeed. I tasted the taste of 120 volts and survived, thankfully.
Yeah, I've gotten quite a number of those kinds of shots, but never to a water, never from a hot chassis to a water pipe. That's dangerous.
Intuition.
Wesley recognized, yes, indeed, Ed. Thankfully, I was very young, and I had very good reflexes, and I jumped back a couple of feet and took a little time to figure out what the hell was going on. And unfortunately, American 5's chassis could be live. They had unpolarized cords, and one of the lines went to the hot end. So if you put the plug in, quote unquote, the wrong way, your chassis was live. Your safety feature was that the front usually was made out of something like Bakelite, which was an insulator. But if you were semi-foolish to go over to the window and brush up against the chassis at the base that was not covered by anything, the chassis was sitting there in the back. So if you put your hand anywhere near the back of it and you happen to be near a water faucet at the time, then you connected a circuit. That was hopefully the first and last circuit I completed.
One quick thing before you give it to Wesley.
Sure.
Having studied this extensively, I will tell you, don't thank your youth and quick reflexes for saving you. I have found that at 120 or even 230 volts, what happens is your muscles, like almost involuntarily, draw your hand back. Above 1,000 volts, it physically blows you away. But the danger is around 480 volts. That is the real killer, because that's when the muscles clamp down.
Yeah, that's true. And I was not holding, I was holding on to the faucet. I was not holding on to the rear of the chassis. So most likely anything that changed the position of my arm would cut the circuit, thankfully. So, yeah, some of it was reflexes. My legs were reflexes. My arms probably was just the muscles doing what happens when they get a look at the 120 volts of electricity. So, Wesley, you wanted to say something?
Executed with 60,000. I've got a good school. Never go to the electrical circuit of the high voltage with two hands. Did with one hand. And if it happened that you got electrocuted with two hands, bend your knees, bend your legs. This is the only way way to survive. When I was young, still a kid, I was electrocuted hundreds of times, playing with different kind of electric, of the equipment, electronic equipment. But I always remembered that lesson. So it's very important that the circuit is closed, not through the heart. And to a shift.
Yep, that certainly is good advice. I was more cautious when I was using electronic devices. When I was a little kid, I was placed in charge of making sure the television worked. And I never electrocuted myself because I respected it. When I took the cover off of it, I understood the risks involved. I didn't even think twice about the American 5. I don't think I even knew it was an American 5. It was just my parents' AM radio that they stuck down in the basement. So, different way of looking at things. Any other comments on this subject out there? Feel free, hit that push-to-talk button. Okay, I guess we're talked out about that. I hope we're not talked out about everything. Once again, I am AC2GS. This is the Limark Technical Net, and we're here to talk about interesting aspects of amateur radio, hopefully, and if not amateur radio, at least some aspect of science and technology. So if anyone has any questions or comments for tonight, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign.
WA2VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that if anybody out there has very low frequency monitoring capability, that Grimpton alternator station SAQ is going to be doing a test transmission. They send a regular message out on the day before Christmas that if you on 17.2 kilohertz, they're going to be going out. It's going to be at 0800 UTC on the 24th. They'll be sending out a test message, a general greeting message. At 17.2 kilohertz. That's that alternator station, 200 kilowatt Anderson alternator. Go ahead.
0800 UTC is 3 a.m. Eastern.
That's right. It's 3 a.m. Eastern, 0800 UTC.
Thank you very much for that.
Oh, incidentally, also, it's going to be, I think, live streamed on YouTube. You can go on the website if you want more information, www.alexander.n.se. Alexander.n.se for the Alexander SAQ Grimpton website.
Okay, very good, John. I'll try and remember to put that on my link page before the night ends.
What is the YouTube channel name?
The website is alexander.n.se. I think that's Sweden. This is in Sweden. This is from the Grimpton Friendship Association. So,
Yeah, that is also the name of the YouTube program also on YouTube. Again, they're doing the live stream on YouTube begins at 2:25 a.m. That would be Eastern Standard Time, and then startup and tuning is at 2:30 a.m. And then at 3 a.m. the transmission begins. Again, that's 17.2 kilohertz.
Question?
Yes.
Any estimate of transmitting power and any estimate of the size of the antenna?
Oh, yeah, that information is on the website. The full power of the alternator is 200 kW. And there are some pictures of the tower there and the, I guess it's the loading coil for it. Again, it's a monster. But there's some nice pictures of it there at the website.
Yeah, because basically, as one thousandth of 20 meters, so we would expect the antenna to be 1,000 times larger in every dimension.
Yeah, it's huge, as you would say. It's quite a monstrosity for the antenna. WB2CQT.
Yes, CQT.
Yeah, I saw the email from QST about it. You say 17 point something kilocycles, isn't that an audio frequency?
Well, it's audio if you propagate it as a sound wave. I mean, you won't hear anything at the antenna site because it's propagated as an EM wave. But yeah, if you if it was fed to some kind of mechanical transducer, yeah, you'd hear it as sound, probably at the upper limit of your hearing.
Theoretically, you could have an antenna going right to a loudspeaker, but I don't think you'd want to hear that piercing squeal.
And my question is, who has something that'll receive that? I don't.
Oh, there's a number of receivers. Yeah, one of them is the Wendell and Gottelman, Goldterman, and that's PCM-139. Well, there is also Hewlett-Packard one. Back to you.
I have seen receivers that will cover it, but I must admit, I've seen them advertised. I've never seen anybody actually owns one.
WA2BDH. Yeah, as far as receivers, there was a surplus receiver that was around for a while called the RBA5. It tuned down to, it tuned 15 to 600 kilohertz. But actually, I have the Japan Radio Company, NRD515, it essentially tunes down to DC. I can tune it to zero frequency, and the local oscillator comes barreling through. But below 100 kilohertz, it's a little insensitive. But what I've done is I've got a low-frequency antenna with a preamp, so I can copy, I can copy WWVB, and I copy some encrypted RIDI stations down there around 20 kilohertz, but there's a lot of noise from the flat screen TVs, because all of the sweep frequencies for high definition TV are down in that area, so they're all getting their multiples and whatnot.
I wonder what is the YouTube channel name, because I'm trying to find. I found the page. But what is the YouTube channel name the transmission is going to be live on it?
Well, the only thing they say, let me see, I printed this out. It just says live stream on YouTube begins.
The only thing I could say is just the website, which is alexander.n.se. But I don't see an actual listing for the actual YouTube name of the channel. Let me just check here. There's an info at alexander.n.se. There is a link on the website that goes to the YouTube channel. Because when I printed this out, it didn't copy the link, but on the second page there, they have a link to the YouTube channel from the website, so maybe that would help.
Yeah, when you click on it, it's going to direct you to the window, to the YouTube, and then you could give us the name.
Yeah, I don't have a computer in front of me, so I just printed this out the other day when I was at school, so just to mention it.
Let me see if I can help. Let me see if I have the repeater. Okay, I'm not telling you that this is the Prime YouTube channel, but it seems to be the one that most people are interested in. It's called the Alexander SAQ Grimeton Friendship Association.
Alexander SAQ Association?
Grimeton, Grimeton Friendship Association.
Okay, got it. Alexander SAQ Grimeton Friendship Association.
Yep, they're going to have the live stream of the event December 24th.
Yeah, I see it. I'm on a page. I'm on the YouTube channel. Alexander SAQ Grimeton, Grimeton Friendship Association. Yeah, I'm very much into the very low frequency. Now, as far as the antenna doesn't have to be huge. You can have a 10,000th of the wavelength antenna, and it's going to work as well. It's going to work. Receivers are more forgettable. Enter exchange.
Yeah, you can't really use as well, but it'll work because radio amplifiers can deal with microvolts of power, whereas transmission is a different story entirely.
A VDH with a comment?
Yes, John.
Yeah, actually, you know, a couple of years ago, I bought an antenna system made by Low Waves, LOWAVZ, Low Waves. And what it is, it's a very physically small antenna with a little preamp or matching box that has a little transistor amplifier in it with a battery. And I just run this right into my receiver, and I get very good low frequency copy. I can copy most of the beacons there, in a 300 kilohertz range. Occasionally, when I hear the Loran stations go on around 100 kilohertz, I hear that, and I can copy WWVB. At 60 kilohertz, so it's a nice little antenna. It's not physically big, okay, but it does have this little preamp that it does a pretty nice job. There's quite a few down there around 20-25 kilohertz. There's a couple of encrypted RIDI stations, very narrow shift RIDI. I think they're military stuff. But there's a lot of noise, though, a heck of a lot of a noise from the various scan frequencies for HDTV. Go ahead.
Fantastic.
Yes, Wesley?
November 20th, 2022. It's 12:30 p.m. I sent you the email about the VLF antenna. It works from 50 hertz. And there is, when you click on the link, there is on the very top, the first link is going to take you to, what is that? Yes, magnetic antenna for ULF. And it is shown, it is showing two types of antenna, all of the possible problems that the ham radio operator had a problem with, the schematic for the preamplifier, and even if you don't have preamplifier, how to make it. So everything that you need, different types of antennas, what works, what doesn't work. Back to you.
Yeah, that was that hex loop thing.
Yeah, but not only. The hex loop, was one of the things you were trying. There was also waterfall, by Spectrum, I believe, that shows Schumann resonances. So we're talking about 7.85 hertz up to 50 hertz. But it says that the antenna works from 50 hertz up. So there's a number of very, very easy techniques to get to the transmission. I have two receivers that works perfectly with that. And the distance, I believe, is not that far for 2 kilowatts. Enter again.
Okay, you know, I mean, it's just a matter of efficiencies, it's a matter of noise rejection and other aspects, but these things to a degree are usable, you know, whether they serve the purpose or not depends upon the design. I don't want to depress anyone, but I think almost none of us here can hear a 17.1 kilohertz acoustic signal. Maybe when we were 20 years old. I know I tested my hearing, and it's pretty much gone above 10,000 hertz, which is actually decent for my age. You know, we start losing the upper end of our ability to hear high-pitched sounds from birth on. And so there used to be an app that kids in school used to use to signal each other that operated on a frequency high enough that the teenagers could hear it, but the teachers who were older didn't.
When you said that, I have 150 watts from 10 kilohertz up to 25 megahertz that accept either their own generator, which is for CW, for amateur one bands. I'm not sure 9.75 is the lowest band in Europe. I'm not sure how it's. What is the lowest band in the U.S.?
Well, very low frequency is sort of a semi-experimental. You needed an X license up until, 10 years ago, and then they kind of opened it up a little bit once the Navy told everyone that they weren't using them anymore. So it depends on what you think of as an amateur band. If you're talking about the very low frequencies, there are two bands in the very low frequency range that can be used by amateur radio operators.
Yeah, so I can have 0.7 watts, the minimum. Actually, even less than that.